This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Take care while listening and email svri at svri.org for resources.
Why do men use violence? What is happening on a psychological level? It is estimated that 1 in 3 women worldwide have been subjected to either physical or sexual violence in their lifetime. The vast majority of this form of violence is perpetrated by their intimate partners.
From masculine ideals to jealousy, there are many psychological, societal, and cultural factors that lead to this violence. The question is, how can we better understand what's at play and make the violence stop?
Welcome to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margo. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we are exploring what we know about the psychology of men who use violence. Researchers in the field have been focusing their efforts on interviewing these men to try and understand what leads them to their actions. And ultimately, how can we stop this form of violence?
But this isn't just about individual responsibility. There are bigger social and cultural factors that influence their choices. So, why do certain men use violence in certain situations? How do they rationalize their actions? And how can researchers ethically investigate this topic?
To answer these questions, we are joined by two guests. Nambusi Kigombe, co-director of the Gender Violence and Health Center at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine.
And Martin DiMarco, founder of the Inter-American Anti-Femicide Network and researcher in the Crime in Latin America project at the University of Oslo. A quick note before we start. The guests use the acronyms IPH, meaning intimate partner homicide, and IPV, intimate partner violence.
Nambusi, in your research, you have explored the link between romantic jealousy and perpetration of intimate partner violence. Do you want to share some of your key findings or the highlights of the findings from that study?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. This was a very interesting project that was funded by the Wellspring Foundation. And it was looking at interrelational and other causes and drivers of violence against women. And so we were looking at jealousy, and we included in that definition controlling behaviours. And essentially, romantic jealousy was defined as the suspicion of infidelity linked with anxious attachment, low self-esteem, and insecurity in alcohol use. So we used Bunk's framework of jealousy. I won't go into the detail. This has all been published in a paper. But essentially, this built on work that was done on Indanashikura in Rwanda and the Sasa intervention in Uganda. And we found a lot of actually really interesting similarities and some interesting contextual differences. So, for example, maybe in part because of the specific programming on jealousy in Rwanda, it was very much framed as jealousy, whereas in Uganda, it was more related to faithfulness and infidelity. In both contexts, it was recognized as problematic and was also recognized as a driver of violence. So what we also found was that there were gendered pathways through which jealousy led to intimate partner violence, different between men and women. So for women, it was around questioning men in terms of where they'd been, who they were with, and that could lead to relationship conflict, and in turn that could lead to IPV. Whereas the pathways for men were very much around jealousy and suspicion of women being with other men, socialising with other men, or being involved in some way with other men, which in turn would trigger controlling behaviours, conflict and violence. And essentially, what we also saw was in both contexts, jealousy arose out of a breakdown of trust. And this very much, for example, manifested around suspicion. So, for example, in Uganda in particular, if there was a woman who or a household that didn't have sufficient resources and she suspected that he had another woman or he had another child or he did have another child from a previous relationship, the concern that would often result in conflict was that the limited household resources were being transferred to another household. There was also normative influences and the influences of others. So where relationships where a couple had decided on a particular relationship behaviour, so for example, living apart, suspicion from those in the community or relatives saying, oh, why would you let her live away from you? She's going to find another man, would in turn link to jealousy and then violence as well. Another key driver in both countries was around men's jealousy or concern or anxiety around the woman working outside of home and therefore being accessible to other men. And that not only resulted in controlling behaviours, but also economic violence by preventing her from working, which, given the structural context, meant that she continued to be dependent on him because she and her children wouldn't have alternative sources of income. So, I mean, there were a lot of really important findings, and what both interventions, Indina Shikira and Sasa, did in to address jealousy was to improve relationship trust and communication so that the anxious jealousy, in particular, jealousy of fear of another relationship, didn't need to become a source of conflict if people could describe their concerns and find a way of resolving them. And then also, particularly in Rwanda, highlighting and very much engaging around the potential role of jealousy in relationship breakdown. In Uganda, it was much more focused around infidelity, but that's unsurprising because Sasa was also looking to prevent HIV-related risk behaviours. I mean, there were so many findings. As I say, they're in a paper, and I'd very much direct people to that.
We promise we'll share the link to that paper on the podcast notes. So thanks, Nembusi. And it really highlights the importance of local context when we're trying to understand the drivers and protective factors when we're developing interventions for folks.
And Martin, turning to you, could you tell us about your research with men in Argentina who've been imprisoned for killing their intimate partner, or as the field calls it, femicide? What did you find, and did any of your findings surprise you?
The law that we call the femicide law, we have it since 2012, and many other countries in the region have specifically developed these specific legal figures for the intimate partner homicides. And the original idea within the project that we had was to understand, at the beginning, was sort of the stories that these men would tell. The premise of our research was that the narratives of the stories that people tell would provide us with some tools to understand their actions. Originally, we did like several years of fieldwork in Argentina, and in the last 2 years, we continued doing fieldwork in other countries, specifically in Latin America, that allowed us to have a shared language and similar legal criminal codes to some extent. And I think that the most important, most interesting aspect, and sort of connects with what Nembusi was saying before, is first of all, shared narratives about what love and relationships are. And that is extremely important. My background is in sociology because it's not, of course, something individual. So the first thing that I would highlight is that the IPV, in this case, IPH or femicide, is not something of an individual nature. It's not the, I wouldn't agree with the bad apple approach to understand violence against women, more about the structural conditions that allow that or that actually foster any form of violence. And specifically when we talk about femicide, we see that there are frequently the same types of stories about what they expect about a relationship, what type of relationship they expected, what type of fidelity they were considering, and what they considered themselves as entitled for this or that action. We know a lot about the risk factors, which are quite well-known worldwide regarding IPH, for instance, prior forms of physical abuse, threats, jealousy, intimate terrorism, to use a well-known term. But with these studies, we understood sort of the rationality of the men behind. And it is extremely, to some extent, quite of an ethical dilemma because we're humanizing these men to reconstruct or decipher rationality. Something that I find very interesting is that for the region of South America, of Latin America, of course, there are a lot of contextual specificities regarding the words, the situations, the scenarios, which are, of course, something of, you know, anthropological, a bit obvious factor, right? But we found that when studying the emotions or the narratives that are linked to emotions, there are a lot of regularities. For instance, the idea of threats that these men have regarding their intimate partners. So usually, in common sense, we would understand IPV as related to power. And usually, like, the men have power. But in our research, we actually try to argue that while we know we are in a patriarchal society, the main narratives and emotions that drive them is the fear of losing that position. And violence is actually a tool or a strategy used to retain and gain a certain status within a relationship. And that was cross-cutting in all the countries that we've done interviews. Of course, that shows a social structure. We know we can call it patriarchy, but we're trying to provide much more nuance to that big, huge context, which is sometimes a bit useless when we want to implement upstream policies, for instance. And we say, okay, how can we change this? How can we engage men? So we can engage men by trying to change the narratives. It seems quite simple, but to get to know these narratives, this is the process of we're trying to do by speaking and talking to them once, so over and over again, and trying to decode the rationality without thinking it's an individual, just an individual crime. It's a collective crime.
And you also carried, Martin, you carried out research with perpetrators on male violence. Were there some similarities and differences that you noted in their attitudes towards their crime or their motivations?
Yeah, I find it extremely interesting because it's like physically the same action of killing someone, though completely different social scenario. So that tells us a lot about where do we kill. And of course, IPF or femicide occurs mainly within the domestic sphere, houses, especially with partners or ex-partners, and male-male homicide, I would say in most countries of the world, usually the highest prevalence or the rates are within people that we know, for instance, like a colleague or a neighbor or things like that. For me, the interesting similarity is that in both cases, we find men that they can rationalize what happened. They can use neutralization techniques. They can tell us this happened because he forced me to, blah, blah, blah. There are many things. But ultimately, it's related to an extreme feeling of threat, as I said before, which is completely incorporated. And that's sort of the challenge, because they can rationalize and tell us when I'm conducting an interview, they're telling why they did it. But sometimes it boils down to, I don't know, I just was out of control. And that out of control, it is a narrative on one side, it's a story that we've heard, but at the same time, it's an incorporated, what anthropologists would call incorporated thought or embodied thought. It's something that we, because I'm a cisgender man as well, we've been socialized in, we've learned how to feel certain things. And feeling out of control is nothing related to being out of control. It's actually a social norm of how to react in certain scenarios. So male-male homicide and femicide share this aspect of being completely embodied social facts. When I was doing the research regarding male-male violence, most of the men that I've interviewed, and that connects to the sample, I was trying to look for the most recurrent types of homicides, were within brawls in bars or fights with colleagues. And the hatred or threat, which is the other side of the social phenomenon, was too much for them. The same way that jealousy and possession and feeling of entitlement, they're not only a rational decision, they're more of an embodied action. And again, that's extremely crucial for us thinking of public policies, because on our way to design any type of intervention, being from, primary school programs to battered men programs, we have to understand that these are things that have to be very carefully deconstructed. I'm using the word very lightly now, and create a new form of physical and emotional understanding of conflict. So the second similarity relates to how we deal with conflict. And we are, of course, socialized in living conflict in an extremely pervasive way.
I'm just going to hop to you now, Nambosi, and just listening to, some of this data that and the evidence that's coming out of these studies about context, about with these different factors involved. I mean, how is this evidence being used to inform programs to prevent men's use of violence against women?
So I think what really resonated with me is how we can't excuse men's behavior and say it's acceptable, but we can also take time and space to understand it and understand where it's coming from. And this is where context comes up. As he mentioned, men and boys are socialized in a particular way. They are the leaders. They are unquestionable. They are strong. They have the answers. So if you are a man who has grown up also not being allowed to show emotion, not being allowed to show weakness in any way, then when you are challenged with a threat, or when you are challenged with what you perceive to be something that questions your identity as a man or as a provider or as a person of authority in your family or your community, then how you react to that, particularly if you don't have the tools to respond to threats or challenge or anxiety or fear or whatever it is in a non-violent way, is part of the context in which you were raised. So from programming, what I've very much learned is the importance of starting with sort of very much focusing on benefits-based programming. So rather than wagging a finger and saying, you are the perpetrator, you are bad, you are wrong, and what you're doing is terrible. Yes, making clear that violence against women is unacceptable, making clear the impacts of violence against women, but really supporting women, men, communities to have a discussion of what non-violent relationships could look like. So what are the benefits of more equitable relationships, better communication, improved trust, and so on. So for example, in the work I've done in Uganda, particularly around and through SASA, men would talk about the challenge they would feel of going out for a whole day looking for money, in inverted commas. The food that the family eats for the day is based on the money that is brought in that day. The school fees that are paid are based on the money that's brought in. So if they come back at the end of the day, having tried all day to find money and not being able to, then their partner or wife or whatever is asking for money for food and for school fees and for new, so-and-so needs a new pair of shoes and they don't have it. First of all, their masculinity may be insulted by the fact that they can't provide for their family when they should, and also that they're being questioned and they know that their partner is disappointed in them. So in that instance, it might lead to conflict and violence. So could we have a conversation of what the benefits would be for the family if there were two incomes in that family, and actually enabling that space for men to without being judged, say, I'm struggling to bring in money, let's pool our resources. There are cultural norms. There's a saying here that a man's money is for this family, a woman's money is for herself. But through a conversation, discussion, there can be ways of ensuring that relationships and couples work together to support the household's objectives.
What are some of the key challenges that you've experienced in researching men's use of violence against women? Martin, would you like to start? And then Nambusi, just chip in. So
I will start with a politically incorrect thing to say, or perhaps surprising thing. Conducting fieldwork, like specifically face-to-face interviews with men that have killed their partners, is surprisingly easy in terms of face-to-face interaction. Let me elaborate. It is easy because fieldwork with them, they have a very... First of all, any sort of research of this nature has to be extremely proficient in not being naive. I mean, you have to know what you're getting into. My experience, it's been that they have a very clear agenda, or not a very clear, but they do have an agenda, so they accept being interviewed because they want to do something. They want to defend their name, or they want to tell their side of the story. Like any human being, anyone is accepting to give an interview for something. However, disentangle those narratives, it is difficult. And that perhaps links to one of my first challenges, which is we can't have a naive interpretation of the stories, regardless of the approach. We have to denaturalize so many hypotheses and theories and assumptions that we have about violence. I've read so many papers that just go with the flow in terms of either reproducing what they've said without any analytical interpretation, or just use their own assumptions to just force them into the analysis. That's particularly challenging because when you go into the field work with all to the prison and you start interviewing, you found like a lot of nuance. You find a lot of different things, and it's like, how do I interpret this? A second aspect that I found challenging, and I think it's extremely problematic, and it sort of goes to a different level, are institutions. So I've done most of my field work in South America. I've done field work in some sub-Saharan African countries, and institutions are of course gatekeepers here. And there's a lot of resistance and reluctance from both universities and prisons and IRBs to do work with men that have been either they've killed or they've been abusive. And it is a crucial aspect for anyone working in this field to know more about that. So that is particularly challenging, something we have to talk about. Why is this happening? Should we address it? Should we not? And I would say that the third challenge goes to a higher level. and relates us all in regards to the budget and political momentum. So currently my government is against any type of feminist research, as they call it, and that's Argentina. And we get funding from our national government, so that's a challenge for us. Like, how can I apply for any funding or get an approval from the state or the prison when the government directly opposes to that? And that happens in so many different countries and contexts. So having like a clear discussion and clear agenda is like something you have to navigate very carefully. So researchers and people working like practitioners are trying to be very like skillful when talking about these, presenting information, protocols, and so on.
A lot of what Martin was saying resonates with me. And I suppose the one main challenge that I have found in doing violence against women, violence against children, is ensuring that it is ethically and morally supported by a well-functioning child protection referral network. So in some instances, in some communities, when you report an episode of violence at the police, either the police don't understand the issues, they don't take it seriously, men can pay the police and the file disappears. And then having reported it, the woman is perhaps at more risk. Children in the household may be at risk. So what I found quite challenging, and again, challenges are opportunities to address them, is to ensure that any research is supported by a very well-functioning referral system. So I think what really stands out for me is the importance of setting up that system. But where I find that, yes, you can ensure you have a robust system, at the end of the study or at the end of the data collection, what then happens to those individuals, households, communities, when you no longer have the resources to support them and you thank them very much for their participation, you give them their compensation for their time, but you know that unless something happens fundamentally, that violence is probably going to continue within that household. And so one way in which we always, as the Gender Violence Centre, try to address that is to use existing institutions and existing services such that you're referring to services that are already available so that at the end of the study, those services continue to be available. But it is a challenge. In fact, there are studies that I won't do or I can't yet figure out how to do because of I'm not confident that the support that would be available for anyone who reported violence or whoever anyone who was identified to need support is sufficiently robust.
Yeah, and on that subject of self-care and vicarious trauma, and the fact that referral networks aren't always great or supportive, even if they do exist, how do you take care of yourself and your team when doing this research?
And it's something I learned the hard way. I was doing some research. It wasn't directly related to violence, but this was 15 years ago. And there was a particular story that still stays with me now. And I find myself in quiet moments wondering whether I did the best I could for that family that was involved in the research. So for me, particularly for my team, I communicate very clearly that if you are struggling with something, your well-being and your health is more important than the data. We're currently doing a study on sexual harassment in Uganda, and a female researcher who has broad and deep experience of researching violence was researching a key informant who was charged with addressing violence in the community. And he was sexually harassing her and, you know, talking about her body and very much going on and on and on. And she felt so uncomfortable that she pretended that she was unwell and she was just dropping in to check on him and make sure the interview could go ahead the following day. And then we arranged for a male interviewer to interview him. Surprisingly, he was very articulate about sexual harassment. Maybe he didn't recognize his behavior to her as sexual harassment. But I very much communicate to them, yes, we're here to collect data, but your well-being is more important. And I also, for myself, recognize that there are times there are studies that I can't do. I was asked to be involved in the secondary analysis of data from men in Asia who had been imprisoned for defiling and sexual violence against children, and essentially were paedophiles. And it was around their experiences, their rationalization of their behavior, how they think their behavior impacted those children. I had just had a child myself, and I just didn't have the stomach for it. And I felt terrible because it's important that we understand, much like femicide, what's going on in people's minds and figure out how to address it. But I recognize that I just didn't have the internal resources for that, so I declined. But I think it is recognizing why we do this research, doing our best to do the research, but also recognizing that we as individuals aren't going to be effective. We're not going to be able to support the participants we research. We're not going to be able to support the teams and colleagues with whom we work if we are struggling to address the issues we're facing. which again makes me feel like that's a bit of a cop-out, because I'm struggling to hear about it, but there are people who are actually experiencing it, and I'm like, oh, it's too much for me, I can't hear about it. But that's somebody's lived reality, and my inability to deal with that kind of says a lot about how we all experience violence in some ways, but how violence is more acutely experienced by some. If anything, it motivates me to figure out how else to intervene.
I think in my case, it's sort of a work in progress regarding that specific topic. And I think that's due to the fact that the understanding of what it implies to do research on violence, the emotional impact and the all the aspects surrounding the doing of the project is very different between different countries. So different traditions of doing this research have different logics about it. And I feel that I learned quite late in my academic career what it implies to work in a team and work being mindful of the things that we should have discussed before. I think that's my main takeaway, which is discussing before to the level of being obnoxious, the potential, the hypothesis, the counterfactual. So I've learned with a project that I'm currently working with, Sveinung Sandberg, that we've done interviews in prison, in different countries, in prisons in South America. And this implied doing interviews with men that have killed other men, men that have killed their partners or ex-partners, and people that have been sexually violent or raped other people, including minors. And what we attempted to do there, in the people that I work more closely with in Argentina and Chile and to some extent in Bolivia, was to actually talk about that. Are we comfortable doing those interviews? To what extent? And something that someone said within the team is, when you hear something, you won't erase it from your mind. And it's your prerogative as a researcher, as a human, basically, to say no before or after. So having very clear guidelines of how to do that it's quite simple, actually. And I think that has to do with the origin and the genesis of each project. Have we thought about referral? Have we thought about psychological support or assessment? Have we thought about the genders of the participant, interviewer, like the connection there? Have we thought about the age and life experiences? It's a simple chart to say, like a table that you can just draw. When you take into account that, it's the same as a sample, when you do a sample, right? And I think that's crucial. And when designing any kind of research, that makes it feasible or not. When you ask that, that's sort of my main point.
I just want to jump back quickly, Nambusi, to pick up on some of what you were saying before about how the research is used in informing programming. And I just wondered if you could share an example or any examples of what you find the essential components of programs that do work are. Effective programs that actually prevent men's use of violence against women. What are the sort of key elements that you found do make them effective?
There are a number of approaches that have proved to be important. The first is community mobilization. Examples being SESA, Indana Shikira, and very much what these community mobilizations and community activism approaches seek to do is to make violence less acceptable and to celebrate non-violent forms of relationship and relationship conflict resolution. So if you are a man who doesn't necessarily believe that violence is appropriate, but you get laughed at by your relatives, your friends, your whoever else, you may use that violence because you think everyone else thinks it's appropriate. So community mobilization, where everyone is moving in the same direction and everyone is rejecting violence, is a really powerful way of enabling improved relationships to actually become part of a community. And importantly, those behaviours, for example, when you see your parents resolving conflict or your father using violence against your mother as a child, you're more likely to use it as a man or experience it as a woman. But if we are raising communities whereby there isn't violence in relationships, then it's less likely that children themselves will grow up into relationships that use violence. So community mobilisation, community activism is one approach that has shown much promise. There's also gender transformative approaches, whether this is empowering women to be more independent financially or in terms of improving gender relations and harmful masculinities and femininities. Gender transformative approaches have also shown that we can, through very targeted, very specific intervention, improve the dynamics in relationships or break down those aspects in relationships that make conflict more likely. So, as I say, around harmful masculinities, toxic masculinities, and so on. And then a lot of interventions, particularly secondary prevention, around couples, working with couples to improve communication, improve collaboration, reduce conflict, and so on. And then violence, as I mentioned earlier, is intergenerational, as we all know. Children's exposure to violence predisposes them to either use or experience violence later in life. So there is also evidence around school-based violence prevention interventions, as well as parenting interventions. So the common thread is having that conversation about violence, defining what it is. In a lot of communities, and this is across the world, you'll have narratives of women saying, oh, if he doesn't beat you, then he doesn't love you. Or it's acceptable for a man to beat a woman if she burns the food or if she gossips. So violence is not necessarily seen as a good thing, but is broadly accepted in a lot of communities across all genders and so on. And I think that's a really important shift, because in communities where violence isn't even recognised as a problem, then any intervention that seeks to address it will never sort of get anywhere, because no one will necessarily feel the need to address it. We're at a point in the violence field where we are learning what we can do. We can advocate, and you know, the funding is increasingly available to actually do something for it. And importantly, policymakers and others are recognizing that addressing violence isn't just a interpersonal social issue. It's a health issue. It's an economic issue, as the SDGs are also recognizing of violence, and there are actual key targets around that. So the Sustainable Development Goals also recognize, as a global community, that there is a need to address violence.
Have you experienced backlash or resistance to researching men who use violence against women personally?
No, thankfully I haven't. I think perhaps because of the research that I've done has been linked to HIV, it's been linked to violence against children, it's been linked to jealousy and so on. What I have received, sort of not resistance, but in, for example, public dissemination and activities related to sharing the results, people asking, why are we talking about violence against women? How about violence against men? And very much trying to make out that women are equally violent and this isn't just a problem of men being violent. And it very much feels like men particularly, and women, one, violence, and again, any violence, so I want to be clear, any violence against anyone should never happen, it should be censured, but they're not recognising the individual, the community, the structural power, financial power that men have over women that structure violence against women, as opposed to perhaps interpersonal, individual examples of power or violence against men. So I've had to, more times than I would have expected, defend why we focus on violence against women and not on violence against men.
And a little bit of an ethical question, I think, because I think there's a lot of ethics in this type of research and this work inherently, and it's about values and principles. But how do you balance your duty of care to the participants of your studies, to your duty of care of those whom the people that you interview and research have harmed?
The first thing, it's working with men that have been either physically violent or that have killed someone doesn't imply any difference in terms of the ethical guidelines that we follow. So like the baseline, like we used informed consents and so on, and like we follow the same type of criteria. However, there are certain circumstances in the specific work when we interview someone that it's being kept in an institution, whether it's a program for violent men or a prison, that we have to have extra care about certain things. I don't find it personally challenging or not challenging. I don't find it dilemmatic. I don't find a dilemma there because I think it's quite clear. I'm doing research with a specific feminist objective. It doesn't imply that I should put these men in danger. And the truth is that specifically in prisons, there's a lot of danger for them when speaking because they are seen as people within the prisons will see that they might be making excuses or that they think that I'm a reporter and that they are going to clean their name. And there are a lot of potential informal punishment for them. So we've tried in so many different ways to sort of create a safe space for them and for us within those environments. And that has implied a lot of resistance from people that have read our work, have read the methodology that we've implemented and have been against it because they don't think that these men have any form of rights, which I disagree with. And I would say that the second issue, it's a bit more like technical, but I think it's equally interesting, is that since I mainly do biographical research, so basically I work with the men's history and story, when I report the results in any form, I'm basically telling about their lives. And since in some countries like Norway, where I live, that the femicide rate or the IPH rate is really low, everyone knows about the cases. So if I say something about the guy who used a shotgun with to shoot the ceiling and that, everyone in the country, all 5 million regions, will know who that person is. That's an extreme example, right? So confidentiality and anonymity are crucial. They can lead to so many different problems. I don't care about the specificities of the case. So when I publish a paper, write a report, do a social media event or anything, we have to be very clear. And I go back to the being clear and being having a conversation with the team about how to present information. And that usually implies creating new cases, doing a bricolage, or anything that could allow me to communicate something in any way, while at the same time keeping anonymity of the participants. I know this is something that some people struggle when one talks about this, but rules shouldn't be different when thinking about the ethics of research, when regardless of the topic, like in this case is IPV and perpetrators.
Are there any last thoughts or sharing? Are you feeling optimistic about the world?
No.
Oh, no.
I mean, the political momentum is not really good. The Trump elections, I don't know, Milei. I think that we are reaching a stage of having open conversations about certain topics, which are incredibly good. Or I'm getting older and I'm seeing new discussions and conversations. But regarding that, I think, yeah. And I think that within the field, let's talk about the field of GDB. I don't know if that's a field in itself. It's very well now developed. Or everyone, I think, understands that we are doing research that seems sometimes very academic and theoretical, analytical, but with a clear impact, or I think at least impact on, I will use the word policies or prevention in a broad sense, that might be communication and changing the script of a soap opera, or it might mean a policy for a bystander program. It doesn't matter. And I think I am seeing those threats a bit more clearly right now, in spite of the political context that some countries are facing.
Nambusi, how are you feeling?
No, I share the horror with Trump. But I think I still very much relate to what Martin was saying there about context and so on. Ever since the WHO multi-country study on violence against women, we've known, and then before that, we've known that the incidence and prevalence of violence against women varies across countries, across contexts, and across time. So am I feeling optimistic? In some ways, yes, because there are countries that have relatively low prevalence of violence against women, intimate partner violence. All countries do have some, but relatively low. And when we compare that to countries with very high prevalence, we know that there's a lot we can be doing. I think what makes me optimistic is the sense I'm getting that it is increasingly recognized as a health issue, as a social justice issue, as a rights issue, as an economic, and so on. So more and more sectors are now understanding why they should get involved in addressing violence. It's not just about human rights. It's not just about injuries, not just about whatever else. We know, for example, HIV, women who experience IPV are more likely to have HIV or to be exposed to HIV. So when every sector starts to understand why it's in their interest to address violence, I feel that there will come a tipping point, and at that point, we can really build on that momentum.
Thank you to you both for being part of this journey. We are at it, and you know, hopefully we're accelerating our way to that tipping point. So inshallah, and thank you both.
Thanks to our guests, Nambusi and Martin.
Season 3 of the podcast is in full swing, and we have many more great episodes like this lined up for the rest of the year. If you're learning from the podcast and finding it useful, please subscribe so you never miss an episode. And leave us a review. I am Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I'm Aisha Margot, and you've been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our vision, visit www.svri.org. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.